You're listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. Unceded Airwaves is broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded, and current lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Indigenous girl, indigenous girl, lifestyle, 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 1, 2, 1, 2.
Today's show intro was Indigenous Girl Lifestyle, Idle No More Speech by JB, the First Lady.
Unceded Airwaves broadcasts every week from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Autumn Schnell Vilji, I'm Treaty 11 Gwich'in and Inuvialuit on my mother's side. I was born and raised in Amasquatchi, Wisquiagin, traditional lands of the Cree, Métis, Nakota Sioux, and Soto peoples. And I acknowledge that I'm an uninvited guest on Coast Salish lands, and I'm so grateful to be here. I've been here for about 6 months, and I'm grateful every day. Do you want to introduce yourself, Melissa?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Melissa Haberl. I am a settler of mixed German and Austrian descent. I'm originally from Epiquet, also known as Prince Edward Island. That's the traditional and unceded lands of the Mi'kmaq people. Yeah, and I'm also really grateful to be here today and every day here at UBC on Musqueam land.
Thanks, Melissa. You're listening to Season 3, Episode 10 of Unceded Airwaves. Today, we will be interviewing Carly Baker, a student at UBC, about land acknowledgements. And then for the second half of the show, Madison and I interviewed Zoe Duclos, a journalist who worked with Discourse Media on Site C. But before we get into it, let's set our intention for the day. So we are the Indigenous Radio Collective. Every week, we discuss Indigenous issues, current events, and entertainment. We are a collective of Indigenous and non-Indigenous students who use our weekly airtime for our own self-representation.
We strive to center Indigenous voices on our show and to build narratives that empower Indigenous people. Unceded Airwaves is our opportunity to share and define the diversity of Indigenous cultures and highlight some influential Indigenous people.
If you can relate to the goals of the show and are wondering how to get involved, please reach out. You can always reach us on social media. We have Facebook and Twitter. And if you have a voice for decolonization, then we want to hear from you.
Everyone is welcome, and there is no experience necessary. Our weekly meetings are every Wednesday between 1 and 2 p.m. at CITR in the lower level of the Nest. If you want to get involved but don't want to be on air, there are plenty of other ways to participate in the collective.
You can follow Unceded Airwaves on Facebook and Twitter. If you're aware of a great Indigenous artist, send us a tweet using the hashtag UncededMusic or send us a Facebook message at Unceded Airwaves, and we will do our best to get it on air. And if we play a song you send us, we will even give you a shout out.
We're always looking to hear from our listeners about what you're up to, so let us know about any Indigenous artists that you're into right now and what events you're attending or promoting. As always, we'll post a link to the podcast of this episode after the show. We'll also have our weekly Unceded events listing to share a little later in the show.
I hope gratitude. friends in some ways out there. In your spirit, little spirit. I don't wanna be a master of deception. If I cheat on you, I'm cheating myself. I don't wanna be out of question. That ain't good for nobody.
You just heard Stay With Me, remix by Mob Bounce.
Now I'm sitting here with Carly Baker. Hi, Carly. Can you give us a brief introduction about yourself, your names, pronouns, and work?
Yeah, Tanche, Carly Dushnikanshan. Hello, my name is Carly. I'm Cree Métis on my dad's side, and I signed Exceller on my mom's side. My family comes from Treaty 1 territory, the Red River Settlement in Manitoba, but I was born and raised on Stalo territory, which also known as Mission. And I'm an MFA student here at UBC. And I'm a writer, I guess, as well. And my pronouns are she, her.
Lovely.
Okay, so you've been doing a lot of traveling and public speaking events to promote your first book. Do you start with a land acknowledgement? And what does that usually sound like when you're at events?
Yeah, when I travel somewhere new, I take some time to research the land that I'm on, that I'm going to be on, which helps me to feel more tethered to the land and also allows me to show respect as a guest. Also, I've noticed, doing some travel as of late, that since Vancouver seems to be more into territory acknowledgements than many of the other cities that I have traveled to, I usually find that it gives me an opportunity to share some knowledge with others. I usually self-identify as an act of respect, and even if an acknowledgement has been done, I usually just acknowledge that I'm grateful to be on the land myself. I've been at a couple of big events recently. I was at the Writers' Trust Gala in Toronto, and there was no land acknowledgement done beforehand. I was really shocked because there were actually, like, Louise Bernice Half was receiving an award. Wow. There were a lot of Indigenous authors there, many of them shortlisted or receiving awards, and it didn't happen. And I know, like, I was sitting next to my partner, Sean, and we both just sort of sat straight up and thought, what's going on here? And I have to give a big shout out and respect. Well, of course, Louise Bernice Half acknowledged the territory when she went up to speak and did an amazing acceptance speech in Cree, mostly in Cree. Mm-hmm. But actually, David Cheriandi, who won the fiction prize, which was what I was up for, he basically got up at quite late and just didn't sort of say, okay, everybody, I'm going to stop things and do a territory acknowledgement, but just took a moment to acknowledge the Anishinaabe peoples. And I just thought, nice, buddy. Classy.
Yeah.
Way to go. Yeah, since cool. Nobody else brought it.
Yeah.
But I definitely will acknowledge whose land I'm on. But it's not, it's my responsibility, but it's also my pleasure, because it helps me to feel grounded in the moment and remember where I am. So it's not an issue to acknowledge the land. It's a pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think should be included in a land acknowledgement?
Yeah, good question. There's sort of the classic land acknowledgements, and anybody who is interested, no matter how little they know, can just Google land acknowledgements. And here on Musqueam territory, we say that we're grateful to be here on the traditional, ancestral, unceded territories of the Hunkaminam speaking Musqueam people. That's obviously not the same elsewhere.
Yeah.
But I like to. There's a lot of conversation about unceded lands, and I'm of the opinion, and there are many of us who believe that no lands are ceded in this country, because I'm allowed to use a generalization here, most Indigenous peoples that I'm aware of didn't feel that that's a broad generalization, so forgive me, but we didn't feel that didn't agree to surrender land.
Mm-hmm.
So I include unceded wherever I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a way of acknowledging that we're guests on this land, someone else's land, where this is stolen land.
Yeah.
So that needs to be included. It's also very important when people ask you, I have a lot of people coming to me asking hey, how do you think I should do a territory acknowledgement? And I often encourage people to talk about what it means to them to be a guest on unceded land, or what it means to them to be on this land at all. As I said, it is a really, if I'm starting a talk, a conversation, to take a moment to ground myself and to sort of, I guess I want to say it's relaxing, and it feels good to think about our ancestors and think about where we are. So I will encourage people to just talk about what it means to them.
Absolutely. So considering all those dynamics you're pointing out, what purpose do you think land acknowledgements hold?
Yeah, I guess I've sort of covered this already. I'm doing long answers here each time. But the purpose of a land acknowledgement is to honor and show respect for a group of people that have been living and working on this land from time immemorial. It's also a way of acknowledging, as I said, that this is stolen land, and even territories with treaty are still unceded.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that that's the purpose, and it's a way to bring the group together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What understanding do you think the majority of Canadians have around land acknowledgements, and what do you think the importance to them is?
Yeah, I wonder if the majority, important term, not all Canadians, the majority of Canadians think of land acknowledgements as an admonishment, as a source of guilt, they're being, a finger is being wagged at them. And I wish that I could change that, because showing respect is a happy thing. It's a joyous thing.
Yeah.
It's your job to show respect, but it's also it can feel good if a person can just get past that initial knee-jerk reaction of defensiveness. That's when the learning starts, and that's when the growing happens. So I suspect that the majority of Canadians maybe don't look at it too favorably, but I hope we can change that.
Yeah, that's fair.
Absolutely. So what do you think, considering that and sort of the reluctance on the part of a lot of non-Indigenous Canadians, but when it does happen, and it's increasingly happening, in areas that you're mentioning, in urban areas, Vancouver, I find it happens a lot more than rural places like Prince Edward Island does not happen.
Yeah.
But considering all of that, what do you think the land acknowledgement means for Indigenous people when they do hear that from non-Indigenous Canadians?
Yeah, this, again, it's if you're showing respect, then I would hope. There's a lot of cynicism around land acknowledgements that I run across among my Indigenous friends as well. So I feel like I shouldn't speak to, I shouldn't guess what it means for Indigenous peoples.
Yeah.
But I hope that a territory acknowledgement that has is thoughtful and has been carefully considered and is given with an open heart, I hope that allows Indigenous peoples to feel comfortable in a situation. Something like the Writer's Trust Gala would have been great for some of us, I can say. But certain events, I hope that it allows Indigenous peoples to feel like they're part of the conversation and like it's valued. I know that's not always the case, but I also know that there's a lot of crappy territorial acknowledgements given and a lot of sort of eye rolling, like, okay, let's just get this out of the way. And so big surprise that many Indigenous peoples are feeling like this is just a token gesture. It's not worth a lot.
Yeah, like it feels like lip service more than it's actually anything that's meant to, actually connect with the reality that we're on unceded land and stolen land and like hold that up.
And I want to give some empathy too to settlers giving the acknowledgements, because I mean I was raised outside of community. I met my Métis family when I was 30 at my grandmother's funeral, and there was a lot of shame involved and a lot of sort of it was challenging.
Yeah.
My next book will be about it, but check out my next book.
Yeah.
So when I started to, when I was fortunate and met with the generosity of people from the Métis community who were willing to educate me and make space for me, and started to learn about, you know, what I wanted to do, self-identification, there's a feeling of nervousness associated with getting up there and doing an acknowledgement. Same with self-identification. I'm always nervous. I trip over my words. I wonder if I'm offending people. I wonder if I'm taking up too much space and whether I'm getting it right. So like empathy to the folks that are struggling through it up there.
Yeah.
Because it's not, there is a lot of pressure and a lot of awareness of colonization, the legacy of colonization. Mm. So it's hard, but, you know, keep doing it, guys. We all make mistakes.
So I suppose an interesting question then would be, like, what does a land acknowledgement mean to you if you hear somebody saying it or a settler saying it? Like, does it resonate with you any more than it would for anybody else, would you say?
Yeah, good question. I notice and I'm uncomfortable if it's not done. Uncomfortable for the people involved.
Right.
I'm definitely uncomfortable for the elders in that situation, and the people that aren't being respected. So I guess, to be honest, for me as someone who, again, was raised outside a community, I'm still learning what it means to be, to have a connection to the land, too. I also went through a long period of this just mistake that being an urban Indigenous person meant that I had to go and find this magical connection to the land, or that being connected to the land meant being connected to nature. So I'm still working out myself what it means. So it's like I recognize the importance. And when I'm giving an acknowledgement, I've started to notice now that as I get more comfortable with my identity, that the best way I could describe it is to feel relaxed. But I think it's just that I feel more whole when I'm doing it. And I sort of wonder if people are going to roll their eyes at that sometimes. But I just noticed that when I received the City of Vancouver Book Award, I had no speech. I didn't think I was going to win it. So I had no speech prepared. And when I won, I went up there, I was just freaking out. And I thought, well, okay, acknowledge the land. You know what you can do here. Acknowledge the land, self-identify. And while I start to speak, I just felt like valid and like it was okay to be there, like I had a right to be there. And so I don't know, I'm giving a long response to say like I feel confident. It helps me to feel confident and connected.
Interesting. Also, congratulations for your award win, by the way.
Oh, thanks. It was a pretty crazy term last term. Yeah, I'm really grateful. And actually, Dr. Dori Nason, who is here at UBC, she was one of the judges on the panel for the City of Vancouver Book Awards. So that was super grateful. I whizzed by one day when I knew I'd been shortlisted to say thanks. And she was just, oh, yes, great. Thank you very much. And after, she said, it was so hard not to tell you that you'd won. So, really, that was just great, and Oh, maybe we'll keep it going. We'll see.
Hopefully. Absolutely. Yeah. You just got nominated for something new as well, didn't you?
Yes. Quill Inquirer. Not Quill Inquirer. The New Quarterly, very thankful, nominated me for a National Magazine Award for a story actually about my grandmother, an essay about my grandmother called In a Canoe, Chasing My Métis Grandmother Like a Dummy. And it's about mistakes that
That's
people make.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And by people, I mean me.
Yeah.
Okay, so one last question for you, Carly. So considering everything we've just been talking about, land acknowledgements, what do you think it means for when it's political figures, and specifically referencing John Horgan's historic land acknowledgement this past year? So what is it? Is it a big step? Do you consider that a big step that the Premier of BC made that acknowledgement to the territory we're located on? What do you think about that?
Yeah. I find that it's a real dance for me in these situations as far as recognizing small victories and just being cynical and just feeling like a dirtbag a lot of the time about things. So what I try to do in these situations, because I think I and everybody deserves a few moments of happiness, and it deserves a small observance of small victories, that I recognize that that's an important thing to do, and that may, if that opens any minds, I won't say changes any minds, but opens any minds, then great. But I mean, you look at what's happening with Site C Dam. You've got the West Moberly and Profit River First Nations that were and many, many more. Mm-hmm. But those two nations that were in court wrestling over their rights for the dam, it's just going ahead. Going ahead. And I recognize there's a lot of politics there that probably I don't even understand. You guys are going to talk about that, I know. So I'm like, sure to listen. But it means something. But, as you said earlier, it's still lip service in a lot of ways. Yeah. And this idea that, well, here's one small handout, and here's how we're going to screw you on the back end, and it's going to be huge.
Yeah,
so,
it's almost like tokenism. Another form of it. Thanks so much for being here, Carly.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So you're a member of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 with discounts on Commercial Drive at
Audio Pile, High Life Records, Mintage, People's Co-op Bookstore, Stormcrow Tavern, The Rio Theater, JQ Clothing Limited, and Bone Rattle Music Limited.
Just playing a game.
It's more than that. It's about adventure and saving the world and having magic.
UBC Theater and Film presents a high-octane dramatic comedy laden with homicidal fairies,
evil succubi,
and 90s pop culture.
Acclaimed playwright Ki Gwin offers a life-changing journey for the geek within us all. Join Agnes the Ass-Headed on her quest to find and free the lost soul of her deceased sister in She Kills Monsters. From January 18th to February 3rd at 7:30 p.m.
in the Telus Studio Theater at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts. It's a Dungeons & Dragons tale exploring sexual identity, grief,
and some hella fierce woman warriors who about to open up a can of whoop-ass on ya.
Now that we've talked with Carly about the importance of acknowledging land and Indigenous nations, we have an interview with Zoe Duclos, who has reported extensively on Site C and the politics surrounding the project.
I'm Zoe. I'm a reporter, and I've done a lot of reporting on Site C.
That's great. Can you explain what the Site C Dam is?
So the Site C Dam is a mega dam that's being constructed in Northeast BC, just outside of Fort St. John. It's in Treaty 8 territory, and it's about 2.5 years into construction. It's very controversial, and I'm sure we'll get into the reasons why.
Yes.
What motivated you to get the investigation started?
I spent some time up in Fort St. John doing a journalism internship, and I met a lot of people who were personally affected by the dam and felt that their stories were not being communicated to the province fairly or in a balanced way. And I kind of became... There's a lot of questions around the dam. There's a lot of things that don't add up and don't quite make sense. Everything from the process for how it was approved to the rationale for why it was approved. And it just seemed like there was a lot of unanswered questions that kind of were right up a journalistic alley to look into.
That's interesting. So the Site C Dam has been approved. Do you know what that means for the Indigenous communities involved now?
Well, that's a bit of a complicated question. There's in Treaty 8 territory, which is where the dam is being constructed, there are 7 First Nations, I believe, who are part of the Treaty 8 Tribal Association, but there are more than that who have signed on to the treaty, and it's actually the largest treaty in Canada. So there's some First Nations who have signed impact benefit agreements with the dam, which means those agreements are private, so we don't know exactly the terms, but basically it's a combination of financial payment, some land transfer, some work opportunities, and the idea is that it's compensating the damage that the dam will cause on the territory. And so some First Nations who are quite far away have signed impact benefit agreements and are in support of the dam, and others who are very close have signed impact benefit agreements. And I've talked to people in those communities, and they say they signed it because they felt like the dam was going ahead anyway, and they may as well try to get some benefit out of it. And then there are 2 First Nations, West Moberly and Profit River, who have refused to sign. I don't even think they've been negotiating impact benefit agreements because they are so opposed to the dam, and they've filed a few different lawsuits, which so far have not been successful. But
wow, that's very interesting.
So I don't know if that actually answers your question, but that's kind of a background on.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. It is a quite loaded question, so, and every Indigenous community will be affected differently, we know, but
yeah.
I'm a band member from a Treaty 8 Nation. I know that there was damage to the Peace Athabasca Delta from previous dams.
Yeah.
What do you think the future implications of the Site C Dam approval will be?
In terms of the impact on the land?
Yes.
Well, from what I've heard from people up there, like the Peace River is really important to the territory and for the First Nations who obviously have been there for as long as we know. The valley is a source of life, and that's where animals live there, plant life lives there, the people would gather there. And so there's a lot of different things that are impacted when the valley is changed. Partly it's how able are they to continue hunting and trapping, and any impact to the valley. And when you flood a river, there's certain animals like moose that swim across the river to get to safe calving areas, and when you make it into a lake, they can't cross it. So then they can't get to the other parts of their grazing territory. So when the WAC Bennett Dam was built in, I believe, the 80s, they created a huge reservoir. It's one of the largest in the world, and it separated caribou, and the caribou herds have never recovered. So things like this dam reservoir is not going to be as large, so the impacts won't be as much as previous dams have been, but there will be interruptions to wildlife. There's going to be interruptions to fish. There's going to be increased levels of methylmercury, which makes the fish more dangerous to eat, which has been a problem from the previous dams. And then the thing that I hear from people there is that you also have to consider the cumulative impact of all the other development that happens in the area. And one concern that I've heard is that this dam is going to provide electricity to make more development happen, which will further increase the disruption on the territory. So they're going to try to develop more LNG extraction and more oil and gas exploration and possibly more logging because now they have more power. So that's a problem. And then, so that's just the environmental and the impact to wildlife. But then on the other hand, it's a really important place culturally for history. There's sacred grave sites and religious sites, spiritual sites in the valley that are going to be flooded. And so those have an importance that I couldn't really speak to, but I've heard of. What I have heard is that the previous dams caused a huge interruption on the water levels because, of course, there's natural rises and flows in water levels with rivers as things thaw in the spring and whatnot, and rivers get higher and then they get lower, and there's a natural system around how that works and what other kinds of things that impacts. And so when you have an artificial water level and they rise it and deplete it at artificial times for energy reasons, that affects the flow and the life of the valley, and that has affected the delta. Like, I heard a story of one person who used to deliver mail on a barge, or he would deliver stuff, maybe not just mail, but he had a little tugboat and a barge that he went through, and then when the dams went in, sometimes the water level in the river at the Peace Athabasca would be so low that he actually had to start carrying a second barge with an excavator on it so that he could dig his way through.
Whoa.
Because there would be such little water. So I don't know what kind of an impact site C will have because, again, it is relative to the dam that's already on the river. It's quite small.
Okay. And then something else that surprised me was that I noticed from your articles you said there was no consent needed, only consultation. And then even then, the definition of consultation can be really loose.
Right.
Can you speak a little bit about what that means and what that means for the Indigenous groups that worked and how they feel?
Right. Well, I can't really speak to how they feel, but what I have heard is that, first of all, there in Canada, there is no legal requirement for the government or corporations to get consent from First Nations. And so that means that they never really have a legal way to say no. And so that challenges a notion of if they are actually a nation. And, of course, we know they are sovereign nations, but Canadian law doesn't really treat them as such because they don't have the ability to actually say no and be treated as an equal decision maker. And so the way that things happened with Site C is that BC Hydro and the government were going around consulting, and they had meetings in the communities throughout Treaty 8. I don't know if they made it all the way up to Nikisew, but I know that in the immediate area they had community consultation meetings where people were able to come speak. They had a panel, the joint review panel, where people were able, from the public and including First Nations, were able to speak. And so that was considered the consultation, but people that I spoke to, especially from West Moberly and Soto First Nations, they felt that whatever they said just wasn't regarded, and it was as though it was kind of just a checkbox that the governor, that BC Hydro had to show that they listened and consulted and took things into account, but they didn't really take it seriously, and they didn't really respond to the concerns. And I think one of the biggest, when I was writing that, one of the main articles that I've researched for on how Indigenous consultation happened, the complaint that I heard from people is that they started consultation way too late. They started it after they had already decided to go ahead with the project. It hadn't officially been approved yet, but all indication from the government is that it was going ahead. And so, like, one, the chief of West Moberly told me, he's like, you can't start consulting after you've already made your decision. Like, you should start consulting if you really mean to consult in good faith. You should consult before you've made the decision and put all the cards on the table and say, hey, look, we think we need more power. What do you guys think about how we should get it? And these are all the impacts. These are the different options that we have for where we could get power from. We want you guys to be part of the decision-making process, and that has never happened. So I think people feel frustrated by that.
Yeah, no doubt. That's wild. Wow.
Yeah. Did anything surprise you that you learned?
Oh, a lot of things have surprised me.
Do you have some examples for us?
One thing that really surprised me was just, I've interviewed Chief Roland Wilson a few different times, and every so often he just talks about how treatment of their information is different from treatment of other information that maybe doesn't come from a First Nation. And that's just really discouraging to hear I know that it happens, but to hear specific stories of how people are treated differently, like, for example, in other, not related to Site C, but in other cases where West Moberly has tried to negotiate with the provincial government on treaty-related issues, they'll say, oh, we didn't ever sign that treaty. You have to go to the federal government to deal with that. And then the federal government says, because technically the federal government is, like, the representative of the Crown, and they're the ones who are responsible for the treaty and with INAC and all that stuff. But then the federal government would say, oh, that's actually a provincial jurisdiction issue, though we can't really interfere on it. And so both of them kind of just pass off responsibility, and this Treaty 8 First Nation is left not able to have the treaty enforced. And so things like that are frustrating. It's also especially frustrating learning specific things about the dam, like the fact that there's, I can't remember the number, but like 14 or 16 significant adverse environmental impacts from the dam. And yet it was approved when other projects in Canada would have one or two adverse effects, significant adverse effects, and they would be rejected based on that. But we have over 10 and it's being approved. And so it always seems to not add up. Like, there's so much to argue against this dam, and yet it went ahead, and I just don't understand it still.
That's insane. And then also John Horgan, when he was saying that it was approved, his specific wording of, I'm not the first person to disappoint Indigenous communities, and I will not be the last. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? And I remember reading an article, I don't remember if it was yours or not, but it was saying that it's not even necessary for electricity. It's just, John Horgan said that it was just for the money now because they put so much money into it already.
Yeah, that his only reasoning for going ahead with it is because they've already spent too much, and he can't ask British Columbians to waste what he said was $4 billion, which I don't buy for a second. But, I mean, I think it was just a safe, cowardly political decision. It was very disappointing, although I wasn't surprised by it. It's especially disappointing because the BC government, up until this point, has not agreed to even really talk about the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, but then John Horgan's government said that they would. And then he goes ahead and does something like this and says, you know, nothing's going to change, basically, is how I took that statement to be. Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, maybe he means well, but he's not willing, I don't think, to make the hard decisions that are necessary to make change.
No, not at all. Especially one thing that I found disappointing was his phrasing when he did the land acknowledgement. Which was like, it's a big step, but what does it mean if it's just words and then you're going to put actions against words that completely contradict them?
Yeah.
I don't know. Just my
own. I know. Yeah, I was actually just reading an article this morning by, I think, Elisa Elliott is her name, in the Globe and Mail. It's an op-ed that she wrote called Memo to Canada. Indigenous people are not your, I forget the word.
No, like, I read that one earlier today, too.
Yeah, and part of what she was criticizing Canada for, which I think completely applies here, is that there's official name changes or like statements, or, you know, Carolyn Bennett calling herself the Minister of Reconciliation, but then actually not doing anything. So it's like just political maneuvering. And so I think having him acknowledge the land that he's on and then say, well, I'm not the first one and I won't be the last.
What does that mean?
Yeah. I think he tried to pass it off as like acknowledging that, yes, he's letting them down, but I don't know. It failed.
Yeah, failed so hard. And I remember talking to somebody, we did a show, not like an entire show, but part of one of our shows was talking about John Horgan doing the land acknowledgements, and the person was very excited. They were like, this is great, the first person to ever do that in British Columbia, maybe something will actually change. And then seeing his actions, like, what, a month, 2 months after? Like, it doesn't,
Actions speak louder than words.
The other thing, though, that I'll say is, like, it is hard to know. We don't have all the information, unfortunately, and we don't always know, like, what the pressure is. Like, I was a totally unrelated story, but I was, last summer, was interviewing a chief in the Tsilhqot'in First Nations, the Kletenquah First Nation, and he had a meeting with Justin Trudeau that summer regarding wildfires, and he said to me that he had never felt more respected and listened to by a politician. And I have a lot of criticisms of Justin Trudeau, but hearing somebody actually feel respected and listens to, that's kind of important. And so it's discouraging to not see the action and follow through. But, I mean, politics is kind of not easy.
Yeah. And I guess so, that it means, like, at least a little bit is changing, which is important.
Yeah,
I just wish it
could
change,
like,
faster.
Change is slow, and it would be nice to have it faster, and it's good to keep the critique strong.
Yeah.
But I still want to have hope that we are hopefully maybe moving forward.
Yeah, and respect is important. So
yeah,
somebody
yeah,
feels respected.
I think that's maybe a good first step. Like, even if he's not able to have the political clout back in Ottawa to make concrete changes, at least maybe he's changing the attitude a little bit. And then, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's hard to know.
Does any of the knowledge that you found on this journey affect your life in any way, would you say?
I mean, I have definitely benefited, I guess, from meeting people up there, and they have challenged my two things. One is that the people who are opposed to Site C and have been for so long are inspiring in the fact that they're not giving up. I thought after John Horgan announced that they were going to go ahead, I thought that the protest would die. I thought they would just give up, but it's like just starting. It's kind of amazing that these people have that much commitment and energy, and people from the Peace region, but also people from the south and people from outside of the province who've kind of made it their life's work in a way. And I find that really inspiring that this matters so much to them, and they see the significance of it, and they're not willing to let it go. And I've just also really loved, I like grew up in the south, and meeting people in Northeast BC was wonderful, and getting to know a lot of the, like, mostly I met people from Soto and West Moberly First Nations, but they were just wonderful and welcoming, and they had such, like, they've had so much resources and whatnot taken from them, and they have reason to be bitter and to complain, but many of them have found a way to focus their life on building community and to doing what they can within their sphere to make their community strong. And I just have so much respect for them, and I'm grateful for them opening their stories to me.
That's beautiful and very inspiring.
These people are amazing.
Is there anything that we can do post-dam approval?
Actually, I haven't read it yet. I should have, but there's an article in the Taii from this week. Andrew Nikiforuk wrote 6 things that citizens can do now. I know Andrew has done a lot of amazing work on this, so I'm sure that will be a good article. And I know that there are, like, the Sierra Club, and there's a whole bunch of different people who have kind of grouped together informal Stop Site C groups. And so there's people who are still doing stuff. I haven't been very involved with that as an activist, but there's a lot. You can definitely reach out to politicians. You should reach out to, or not you two specifically, but anybody who wants to, should reach out to, like, there's a fundraiser called I've Got a Stake in the Peace, I believe. I don't know if you've heard of it, where they're raising money for court cases and experts, because the not only the two First Nations who have used legal action, but the Peace Valley Landowners Association and the Peace Valley Environmental Association have hired a lot of experts to do research on this project and present information to government, and that costs money. So they're continuing to do that. So there's financial ways that you can support the work as well.
That's great.
And I think just keeping it public, like engage with news stories about it, make sure that editors and publishers know that this is still a current issue. Because I think, like, when I first started reporting on this, it was after the construction had already started. So I think news reporting on it had died off, and it was hard for anyone to get stories approved. Like, I had friends who are working at the CBC and they couldn't get stories approved because they said, oh, that's a Northeast BC issue, no one cares. And now it's become a political issue again, so you're seeing the stories. So I think if editors and publishers and producers know that the public is still interested and engaged, then they'll be able to keep reporting on it.
Yeah, it's still current affairs.
So engage with the stories.
Yeah.
What continuing narrative is there to be had about this?
Well, yeah, like I said, the protest is not stopping. So people are not giving up and they're not accepting that this is going to be the end. I don't know if it's happening, but I know that Westmoreland and Prophet River First Nations were talking about filing an injunction because they're trying to figure out if they can file another lawsuit. The previous lawsuits have just regarded the consultation process, which they have lost, but this time they're hoping to. They haven't filed it yet, but they want to challenge the actual treaty infringements and say that, like, according to Canadian law, government has to be able to justify any infringements on treaties and say that, yes, we're infringing, but we need it because of this reason. And they're arguing that with the BCUC report that said we don't need the power, that then they can't justify the infringement anymore. So,
wow. I really hope they go
keep
through
an
with
eye
that.
On that. Yeah. If they file, that will be very interesting. The problem with that, though, is, like, court cases take a really long time, so that's why they were going to be asking for an injunction, which would stop work immediately if it was granted. But that's a pretty tall order. Like, the court would have to be very convinced that there was a compelling argument there in order for them to interfere on a level like that for such a big project, too. So,
wow.
Mm-hmm. So do you plan to continue your journey as a spokesperson for the Site C Dam?
I wouldn't say that I've been a spokesperson, but I definitely will plan to continue reporting on the story.
That's great. Okay.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What's next for you?
I don't know. I have a whole bunch of ideas, but I haven't pitched them specifically yet, so I don't have any specific answers. But
that's fair.
One thing I've been particularly interested in is this community of resistors that has developed, and people who have met each other and become community with each other who otherwise never would have met. And so I'm interested to tell that kind of a story because I think it has lessons for other groups of resistors outside of this particular issue.
Yeah.
So I think I want to focus on that.
Well, thanks so much for being here and for talking to us about your journalism.
Yeah, no, of course. I'm happy to. Good luck with everything, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
that was
Love is Love,
Part 2 by Quantum Tangle.
Now we have unseated events. Here we highlight Indigenous relevant events that you might be interested in attending.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to start with the first one, following up on our episode right now about Sightsee. This is in Victoria, but if there's any opportunity for folks to check it out, it looks like a great event. It's the Sightsee Summit Accountability in Action, happening in Victoria, BC from January 26th to the 27th, with keynote speaker Grand Chief Stuart Phillip of the BC Union of Indian Chiefs. The event is open to those who do not accept the justification offered by Premier Horgan to continue the Sightsee project and flood the Peace River Valley. It is an opportunity to learn more and help decide on new actions and new directions. Registration is currently open.
The Skookum Series of Indigenous Arts invites you to join them for a reading of a new play by Taran Kootenhayu. White Noise is the Sound You Hear Until Something Happens, a comedy about two Canadian families who have dinner together for the first time during Truth and Reconciliation Week. White Noise explores what it means to live in Canada from two different paradigms, how we deal with internalized racism, how do we keep pushing it away and pretend to live safely in our day-to-day, on Saturday, January 13th from 10 to 7 p.m. at the Massey Theatre, 735 8th Avenue, New Westminster.
Right. Our next event is United We Stand, Divided We Fall. This is a rally. It's not an ordinary event. In spite of the awakening of hate crimes, Islamophobia, police brutality, anti-Semitism, hatred, and racism against a multitude of people on the spectrum, we will be holding a rally called Peace for Prosperity. It's important that we, in the midst of difficulty, learn to connect through kindness and love to unite us all, despite race, despite sexual orientation and religion, culture, and background. If you'd like to join the rally, it's being held on Sunday, January 14th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
On the Robson side.
We also have just a final shout out for the Finessa Journal here at UBC. Submissions are currently open. You have until January 21st to submit papers, could be art, literature, any kind of creative writing, to the Journal of First Peoples Writing. This is our republication and revamped journal, and it's going to be coming out this spring. So get your submissions in by January 21st.
And what does Finessa stand for, Melissa?
Oh, sorry. That is common UBC lingo. So Finessa is the First Nations Studies Students Association, and we're relaunching the Journal of First Peoples Writing, which is an undergraduate journal of Indigenous and decolonial studies.
So thanks for tuning in. Thank you to our co-hosts, Autumn Schnell and Melissa Haberl. We would like to thank our sponsors, NORAD Electric and Decolonizing Water. The next program you'll hear is Cue It Up by Jonathan Q. My name is Autumn Schnell, and you're listening to Unseated Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM.